This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
We can do it. Yes, we can. We can change things throughout the land.
I'm as mad as hell,
but we all must lend a hand. We can do it. Oh, yes, we can. Oh, your neighbor over there, a bit bewildered, but he cares. He just doesn't know what to do. Join together, and then there'll be two.
Yes, there'll be two, all right. And away we go. There's two of us today for Call for Best for Truth vs. News. We're back, folks. It's been 2 weeks off, September 10th now. The stock market's had its ups and downs. We've had immigrant crisis and all kinds of things happening, but we're celebrating. Well, not celebrating, but we're remembering what happened back in 2001 on a day tomorrow. Hopefully this is going to play tonight on the 10th, and tomorrow's the 11th. And I have a special, special guest who knows all about that, and his name is James Fetzer, and here is his first slide. And so take it away, James.
Thanks, Don. I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December 2005 to bring together experts from different disciplines, pilots, physicists, engineers, aeronautical, electrical, structural, civil, to pool our resources to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. It was my great privilege last Friday to feature Major General Albert Stubblebine, who is U.S. Army retired, formerly in charge of all U.S. military intelligence. He made many fascinating observations as we discussed the slides, many of the same slides we're looking at here today. Slide two, for example, illustrates all four of the paths attributed officially to the planes, two out of Logan, one out of Dulles in Washington, and one out of Newark, where the general immediately observed that having four aircraft involved and coordinated in such a short period of time indicated a very sophisticated level of intelligence operation, certainly not something we could expect from a band of Islamic terrorists coming from a region such as Afghanistan. I added the ICTS to this image to indicate that it was an Israeli company that was running the security at all four of those airports. Slide three shows what we have been presented as the scene of a crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Notice a complete absence of debris. It's ridiculous. As slide four shows, here's the kind of debris you find at real plane crash sites, which is in stunning contrast with Shanksville shown in the lower right. In fact, Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force retired, involved in air crash investigations as his profession, told me it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up. Slide five shows an interview with a reporter, one of the two on the scene, where both of the reporters explained that the eerie aspect of the crash site was that there was no indication that any plane had crashed there. If you see the next slide, number six, it should show an animated version of the plane, which purportedly crashed upside down after passengers tried to regain control. But look at the size of the plane in relation to the vicinity. How could a plane like that that possibly crashed there without being a massive quantity of debris the claim was made by apologists that this was an area in which mining had taken place, and the plane had disappeared into an abandoned mine shaft. Well, that's not only preposterous right. on its face, but think about it. We know what to do with miners who are trapped in mine shafts. We break out the bright lights and the heavy equipment and dig 24/7 in the hope that by some miracle we might be able to save some of them who would turn out to be alive. That was not done in Shanksville, even to recover the 45 passengers aboard. And may I say, that plane could have handled 289. It's very odd that any airplane would be traveling cross-country, transcontinental. American Airlines and United Airlines couldn't possibly make any money if they were traveling with planes filled only one quarter with passengers. And yet, that's what we were told of all four flights on 9/11.
That
flight 11 had 92 out of 351, 175, 65 out of 351, 77, only 64 of 289, and then Shanksville, 45 of 289. It's ridiculous on its face. Now, slide number 7, Don, shows a photograph on the left taken by a woman living in the vicinity by the name of Val McKechnie. But if you notice, the cloud from the crash does not look like the smoke you would have from an actual plane crash shown on the right. Indeed, instead, it looks like the effect of a demolition having been set off in the middle. Not only that, Don, but students have observed that the cloud geographically is located over a pond, not over the purported crash site.
Oh, is that a problem? Go ahead.
Slide number 8 shows actually the kind of smoke you get from a real plane crash, which obviously is completely different than what we were given at... in this photograph, which it clearly has to have been photoshopped. Now, slide number 9 is particularly important because there's an organization of commercial and military pilots known as Pilots for 9/11 Truth. Pilots for 9/11 Truth did studies of the air ground communications between the planes and found that Flight 93 was over Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, after it had officially crashed in Shanksville. They also discovered that Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had officially hit the South Tower. So we know there's a lot of funny business going on here, Don. It's really rather shocking that this should be the case. Believe it or not, Gerard Holmgren, who was a blues musician from Australia, noticed right off the bat that according to Bureau of Transportation Statistics records, where the Bureau of Transportation Statistics keeps data on all flights that take place in the United States, there was no record for Flight 11 or Flight 77 having even been scheduled to fly that day. We also have records from the FAA on deregistration, which shows that the planes that were used for flights 93 and for 175 were not deregistered or formally taken out of service until 28 September 2005, which raised the questions, how can planes that were not even in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air? This is proof positive that we were deceived about 9/11 because the evidence with which the general concurred shows that none of those four aircraft actually crashed on 9/11 and that all four of the crash sites were fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways.
How about that? Yeah, so most of us know that after 14 years about what's really happened there, so we want to focus a little bit on what we do now, but anyway, that's really odd. You're bringing out some very good things, so I'll let you lead on here, brother. Go ahead.
Thank you, Don. Mm-hmm. Here are four of the five frames the Pentagon has released of 9/11. That's all they've released, even though we estimate as many as 88 cameras at the Pentagon would have covered and revealed what was taking place. We even had the FBI showing up at a Citgo gas station that would have, whose footage would have shown exactly what happened within 15 minutes, meaning the FBI was prepared. They knew they had to go to the Citgo station to obtain that footage, lest the whole hoax be exposed. Now, four of those five frames, Don, show a growing fireball at the Pentagon. The first, in the upper left, which is conveniently labeled plane, shows something that appears to be the silhouette of an aircraft just above the gate mechanism. If you turn to slide number 11, I asked Jack White, a legendary photo and film analyst, to size the image of a Boeing 757 to the tail of the plane seen in the frame. And the fact is, as you can see here, that the plane is more than twice as long as we see in the footage. It's also so that can't possibly be a Boeing 757. So if any plane hit the building, it was a much smaller plane. And as a general observed as well, the white plume that is extending from this small aircraft could have been to fire a missile into the building. Actually, spontaneously and unrehearsed, the general suggested that the what appears to be a plane could have been a cruise missile that had been cloaked to make it look as though it were a plane.
How about that?
That was the general's observation. He didn't need any prompting from me, Don.
Yeah, by way of deception, we'll do war, I guess. So this is all deception, all hands and trickery here. Yeah.
Yes, you're right. And it does appear to that the 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, most of whom had come from the Project for the New American Century, and who also had joint U.S.-Israeli citizenship, and the Mossad, as I am going to explain. Slide number 12 shows what the officials claim to be the case. Namely, that you have this huge airliner, which is 125, has a wingspan of 125 feet, has a tail that stands 44 feet above the ground, just barely skimmed the ground. Imagine those huge engines hanging down would have plowed up enormous furrows in the ground, Don. And it turns out that when I discussed this with an aeronautical engineer, he explained to me that for this plane to be barely skimming the ground at over 500 miles an hour was aerodynamically impossible.
That's
because
right.
of what is known as ground effect.
Right.
That plane at that speed could not have got closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the ground, where 80 feet is higher than the Pentagon is tall.
Yeah.
So what we're being shown here is a fantasy, Don, a fantasy.
But those Muslims, they can defy the law of physics and all this stuff to pull this off, man. They better be scared of the Muslims.
Maybe that explains it, Don.
Yeah, they're
look
powerful.
At the next frame, number 13.
Mm-hmm.
That shows the official hit point. What you see is a chain link fence. There are two automobiles, some enormous spools of cable, and unbroken windows above the alleged hit point. But, Don, what you do not see is a massive pile of aluminum debris from a 100-ton airliner. What you do not see is wings or tail or bodies or seats or luggage. Believe it or not, Don, not even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, were recovered from the Pentagon.
Hmm.
We have been sold quite a song and dance.
For 14 years. 14 long years. Yeah.
And if you look at slide number 14, Don, you'll see what I'm talking about. It just so happened that two lime green civilian fire engines were in the immediate vicinity. They showed up and they extinguished the very modest fires. Now look at what you see there in terms of the lawn. It's perfectly clear and green, unblemished, no debris whatsoever. In fact, no debris is going to show up for as much as 30 minutes. And when it shows up, Don, as slide 15 reflects, there's some very curious aspects to the debris.
15.
I am myself convinced, Don, that this was all dropped by the C-130 that was circling the building, because it would have been too conspicuous to have enlisted men and officers carrying the debris out onto the lawn. This one piece was widely photographed and is the most compelling indication that a Boeing 757 actually hit the building. But notice, Don, it's not crumpled. It's not as though this came from a plane that had been in a violent collision. It shows no signs of being exposed to intense fire. There is nothing there to suggest that it had gone through the kind of collisions and fire shown by the fireballs. And as slide 16 reveals, when we do a close-up, Don, we find that there's a piece of vine entangled in this piece of debris that is not indigenous to the Arlington, Virginia area. Now, there's a wonderful story here, because an attorney from Columbus, Ohio, by the name of James Hansen, noticed this anomaly. Very few Boeing 757s have ever crashed. They're one of the safest airliners ever made by Boeing. And he tracked it back to a crash in Cali, Colombia, that occurred in 1995, where a Boeing 755 coming in for a landing lost its way, passed through a jungle where these vines are found and smashed into the side of a mountain. During the transit, this piece of fuselage was stripped off of the side of the engine. Slide 17 shows you the wreckage there in the vicinity of Cali, Colombia from 1995. So this piece of debris, which is supposed to confirm that a Boeing 757 actually did hit the building, when you track it down and evaluate it, turns out to be a piece of planted evidence that was completely fabricated by having been kept in storage since 1995 in order to be deployed for this purpose. Look at slide 18. There you have another photograph of the area. Again, I reiterate, the vine that is caught entangled in the fuselage is indigenous to the area of Cali, Colombia, not Arlington, Virginia. And I take it it's a very tough vine, because notice how it still has retained its greenish-yellow color, even those many years later, in 2001, when it's put out on the Pentagon lawn. So my presumption is this vine is kind of like a leatherish qualities to retain its color.
Yeah.
The next slide, number 19.
We don't have that one. Don't have that one in front of you. They're not there. They're not there.
Slide 19 is not there?
19 or 20 are not there, no.
19 and 20 are not there?
Nope.
Well, let me talk about what would be there.
Okay.
Where you can find the missing slides. And this sometimes happens when you go from a Macintosh, which I use, to a PC, which I believe Don is using,
that
we lose a few slides. What you would find if you were looking at the slides is Captain O'Brien, who was piloting the C-130. I explained to the BBC when they came to my home, they interviewed me twice, Don, once for 8 hours for the first of their conspiracy file series on 9/11. And I explained to them how the debris appeared to have been dropped from the C-130, so they tracked down Captain O'Brien, who didn't say it was false. He said it was absurd. He didn't say it was false. He said it was absurd, which is not the same thing. But I cannot imagine any other source for that debris. Slide 20, which you cannot see, shows the official trajectory of the plane approaching the Pentagon on an acute northeast approach, and the yellow numbers you cannot see indicate lampposts that it's alleged to have taken out. Now, not only did the aeronautical engineer explain to me how it was aerodynamically possible for that plane to be approaching at that altitude because of downdraft, but it's elementary physics that a plane traveling 500 miles an hour hitting a stationary lamppost would have the same effect as if the plane were stationary and hit by a lamppost traveling 500 miles an hour. It would have ripped the wing open. The fuel stored there would have mixed with the air, and it would have burst into fire, causing the plane to catapult across the lawn. Now, if we can go to, but of course that did not happen. You've seen the clear green Pentagon lawn. Where is the plane that cartwheeled across the lawn? It isn't there. If slide 21 is present, Don, tell me.
Yes.
What you see there is both the official trajectory, that's the green line, where General Stubblebine was rather astonished because of the extent to which it is alleged to have penetrated inside the building all the way to the C-ring, where it's purported to have caused a blowout in the next slide we'll visit. But where those yellow lines, Don, this is really fascinating. Two 9/11 students who call themselves Citizens Investigative Team realize that the official trajectory passed south of a Citgo station that's in between the series of gold lines and the green lines, and that there were many witnesses who reported having seen a plane approach the Pentagon north of the Citgo station. So they drew in the trajectories that were observed by those witnesses who saw the plane approach. This plane appears to have been 300 feet in the air, even as it approached the building, 100 feet too high to have hit the building and to have swerved over it. I have a friend from JFK Research whose trucker buddy was in front of the Pentagon at the time and who reported to him that he watched as a Boeing flew toward a big plane, flew toward the Pentagon and then swooped over it. At the same time, explosions were set off in front of the building. That appears to be how it was done. I wanted to have him on the air. His name was Dave Ball, but my friend Roy Schaefer said he was reluctant to do it. I said, Roy, tell Dave that he's much safer if he comes forward and explains what he knows, because then he'll no longer be at risk. Instead, unfortunately, he was found dead in an abandoned building 2 weeks later.
Oh, really? Wow.
The next slide, number 22, shows a hit in the C-ring, which a general observed was impossible given the acute approach of the plane. In other words, that's a perfectly round symmetrical hole, and if you look carefully in the circle, it says punch out. This appears to have been created using military explosives, where many reported the smell of cordite at the time. But the general observed that that hole in the C-ring could not have been made by an airplane on the green trajectory approach that we have just reviewed. Slide 23 is important because here you have reporter Jamie McIntyre reporting from the Pentagon in the immediate aftermath in response to a question from his anchor inquiring about the plane that hit the building. He said, well, you might think that, but from my close-up inspection, there are no pieces of debris that would indicate a large plane had crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. He said that it went out over the air. It was very important, completely accurate. And he was so pressured, Don, that he later had to come on the air and say, only a fool would say that no plane had hit the Pentagon, which you could say being truthful, meaning he had been a fool to think that he could report the truth about the Pentagon and he wouldn't suffer indignities and pressure from his own company, CNN, in this instance, so that he retired. I think he became tired of carrying lies for the government and for CNN. Slide number 24 shows more confirmation from April Gallup, who was a civilian employee, where the explosion went off when she turned on her computer. She had her infant son with her. She walked out of the enormous hole in the Pentagon that had been created by the explosion and observed no pieces of aircraft, no jet fuel. Nothing was on her. Nothing was on her infants. Nothing to indicate that a plane had actually crashed there, which, of course, is completely consistent with all the evidence I've been presenting because no plane crashed at the Pentagon. Here in slide 25, you see General Stubblebine giving an interview to a German reporter, which is why the words you see there are in German, explaining how he could tell that no plane had hit the Pentagon because he'd reviewed the photographic evidence, and there was no indication of any aircraft wing imprint on the Pentagon wall, which incidentally is surfaced with limestone, which is a relatively soft, porous stone. Had a plane hit the Pentagon, you would have seen the imprint of the wings, which did not take place. The next slide, the Pentagon was surprised to learn, this is slide 26, that later in the afternoon, the rumor was spread that the Capitol building would be next. And members of the House and the Senate poured out on the steps, looked across the Potomac, Don, and saw billowing black smoke. That puzzled me because I knew that those lime green civilian fire trucks had extinguished the very modest fires at the Pentagon virtually immediately within 15 minutes, and there was no smoke coming from the crash. So I tracked it down, Don, and discovered that this billowing black smoke was coming from a series of enormous dumpsters in front of the Pentagon, not from the building at all. This was a classic Hollywood-style special effect, Don.
Smoke job, yeah.
A smoke job. I like that. Another student of 9/11 came by my home in Duluth when I was still residing there before my retirement in June of 2006 and showed me 44 more frames, Don, where you could see light between the dumpsters and the building, and all the smoke was coming from that series of enormous dumpsters.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, slide 27 is highly explanatory about what was going on. This was General Wesley Clark at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, where he reported that after he returned to the Pentagon from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, which means he was the commanding general for NATO, he encountered another general who called him at his side and said, "General, we're planning to attack Iraq." And Wesley Clark said, "Why?" He said, "Were they involved in 9/11? And the general said, "No, sir. We're planning to attack Iraq." And neither of them could figure out why. So Wesley Clark said he asked him to keep him informed. He returned sometime later, encountered the same general who said, "Oh, General," he said, "are we still planning to attack Iraq?" And the general said, "Oh, sir, it's much worse than that." He called him into his office and he explained he just received a memorandum from the Department of Defense, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, stating that we were going to destabilize the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya and ending with Syria and Iran. And General Clark was simply dumbfounded. He said, "Why are we doing this?" And the other general said, "I don't know. I guess it's just because we're good at doing that." And Wesley Clark asked him, he said, "Is this memorandum classified?" And the general said, "Oh, yes, sir." And he said, "Well, then don't show it to me because I'm going to want to talk about it." And eventually he did. Seven countries in the next 5 years. Well, what seven countries were those? If you look at the next slide, 28, you'll discover that Benjamin Netanyahu had anticipated the future because he held a conference in Jerusalem on terrorism and published this book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, in 1987. This was 80s. Just a few years before the demise of the Soviet Union, shown in 29 here, Don, where in 1991, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, only one superpower remained. And that, of course, was the United States. So if you turn to slide number 30, you see the incipient, the growing plan, the formation of the plan that something must be done. Because this group of so-called neocons, neoconservatives in the Project for the New American Century, believe that with the demise of the Soviet Union, there was a unique opportunity here for the United States to create an empire worldwide that would endure for the next 100 years. But they were troubled that the American people might not realize this unique opportunity existed and would let it slip through their fingers. So they even published about it in their research documents, including revising America's defenses. And if you can read carefully here, you'll find they state that this opportunity is likely to be lost unless there should be some traumatic catalyzing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor. So they went about setting it up. And in the next slide, you see two of the key players here, Paul Wolfowitz holding his hand, pulling his hair back, and Richard Pearl. would become key players in the Department of Defense when all these members from the Project for the New American Century, which was supported by Dick Cheney and by Donald Rumsfeld, among others, and where William Kristol of the Weekly Standard and Charles Krauthammer were prominent proponents, it would turn out, of the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq, and appear to have played a key role in the background in supporting this enterprise. Slide number 32, of course, shows the Twin Towers. These were two of the best engineered buildings in the world. They were 110 stories tall. They had a tremendous safety built into them. John Skilling, one of the engineers that constructed, said they had a safety factor of 20, which meant that every floor could support 20 times the load it was expected to carry, even when it's filled with people, employees, desks, furniture, computers, and the like, which is known as the live load. They were designed to be incredibly robust and received awards for their engineering. Slide number 33 and gives asbestos. You an idea of how it was done, Don.
Yeah, but it also had a lot of asbestos in there. So
I'm getting to that, my friend.
Okay.
So here we have, it was called a tube within a tube design. You see that central 47 massive core columns which supported the structure and created all this open space from the core columns out to the external steel support columns. So it was an extremely robust arrangement where the core columns and the external steel supported columns were connected by steel trusses anchored at one end of the core columns at the other to the external steel support columns. In slide number 34, Don, you'll see that the steel was very thick in the sub-basement, 6 inches thick, then 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, tapering off to about a quarter inch thick at the top. What this means is that the great mass of the steel was at floors below the floors that were hit. For example, Charles Baldwin, who was a former high school math, physics, and chemistry teacher, calculated that for the 14 floors above the hit point on the North Tower, those 14 floors only represent 1.4% of the mass of the steel. The idea that 1.4% of the mass of the steel could overwhelm the lower 98.6 is simply ridiculous. These buildings could not have collapsed. On frame 35, you see the way the buildings were laid out. Many Americans to this day do not realize that in addition to the Twin Towers, there were five other buildings, and we're building the seventh, known as Building 7, was a 47-story skyscraper that would collapse, and it would be a bona fide collapse at 5:20 in the afternoon, about 7 hours after the destruction of the Twin Towers. Now, Flight 38 explains that there was a demand imposed by the Port Authority building, the New York Port Authority, that they had to remove the asbestos from the building. So you're completely right about that, Don. Asbestos was a major problem. At the time the building was being erected, asbestos was being sprayed on to contain, control spread of fires. It wasn't to protect the steel, but to, control the spread of fires, because ordinary office fires would never get anywhere near the temperature required to cause steel to weaken or melt. In fact, Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel used in the Twin Towers to 2,000 degrees for 4 or 5 hours with no adverse effects, neither weakening nor melting. And in fact, Don, that was tested in 1975 when an enormous fire developed on the 13th floor of building the North Tower, which burned at some 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 or 4 hours, and when it was done, they did not have to replace the steel. It was at this point in time that they installed a water sprinkler system, at which they had to neutralize, because otherwise the water sprinkler system would have extinguished the very modest fires that remained after the fireballs consumed whatever they had previously positioned to create the impression that the plane had exploded after it entered the building. Flight 37 shows the remnants of the World Trade Center, notice what is so striking. It was all and only buildings with a WTC designation that were affected. None of the other buildings in the surrounding area suffered extensive damage, a few some collateral damage. But it's clear that it was the World Trade Center that was targeted, all seven buildings. In fact, Jesse Ventura has made the nice point that you had three skyscrapers that were taken down purportedly by two planes. He asks, how can you do that? Well, that's a very good question. Slide 38 reflects that Turner Construction was involved in a renovation projects at the Twin Towers, as was purportedly Ace Elevator. These renovation projects appear to have been the cover from installing a sophisticated series of mini or micro nukes that were used to take out the buildings, as I am going to explain. But it's truly fascinating that the records have all but disappeared. In slide 39, you see three of the key players, prominent Zionists from the New York community, who include, a key player in the Jewish community, Ronald Lauder, Frank Lowry, who is a contractor, Paul Eisenberg was on the Port of Authority board, who arranged for the Twin Towers, for the World Trade Center, to come into private hands for the first time. And that, of course, as the next slide shows, was the hands of Silverstein Properties, where Larry Silverstein was the first private owner. He insured it with a new insurance company. He fired the company that had been looking after the security claimed a double indemnity because of two plane crashes. He would wind up receiving over $4.5 billion for a $114 million investment. They don't call him Lucky Larry for nothing. The next slide shows the company that was hired to replace, which was Kroll, another Israeli company. And you got the Jules Kroll on the left, and Jerome Hauser, who was the manager for the World Trade Center, on the right. We're beginning to get the impression of what was going on here and who would actually benefit from 9/11. Indeed, as the next slide shows, there was an Israeli company known as Odego that was messaging and warning people not to come to the World Trade Center. Employees who worked there, I even had a little old lady from Brooklyn call me, Don, and tell me how their rabbi had warned the members of her synagogue not to go into Lower Manhattan that day. Obviously, the word was out. Even Willie Brown admitted that he had been warned by Condoleezza Rice not to fly on 9/11. He would later retract that claim, but that he made the claim in the first place it is when he was speaking the truth before he was put under pressure to revise what he had said. Goldman Sachs, of course, is a very prominent player in all of this with close ties to Israel. The next slide shows what the 9/11 researcher Elias Davidson has reported, namely that the government has never been able to establish that any hijackers were aboard any of those planes. And in fact, Don, we have the passenger manifests that were published on CNN immediately thereafter. You go through the passenger manifest and you'll see there's no name of any Islamic hijacker. In fact, there's not even any Arabic name whatsoever.
Right.
I did a debate with a fellow who goes by the handle Gravy about 9/11, who during a break in our debate, which was three parts that has been widely broadcast, that, oh, yes, their names were on the passenger manifest. Mm-hmm. He pulled out a paper that had their names written in pencil at the top and the bottom. And I pointed out to him that was an obvious fabrication.
Oh, yeah.
Completely ridiculous, Don, yeah. And he didn't bring it up again.
Yeah, I checked those names too way back on 9/12 of 2001, and there were no Arabic names in there at all, and very low traffic that day on those things. So it was complete fabrication. Yeah, and I showed Building 6, by the way, too. What was left of Building 6? I didn't reject that. Go ahead.
Well, it's completely ridiculous, Don. Right. And now it turns out we know that the 9/11 hijacker passports were issued by the CIA.
Oh,
where we have a U.S. consulate whistleblower explaining that he was ordered to give the visas to the eventual terrorists, those who would be fingered falsely, and where another whistleblower, Indira Singh, claimed the company PTAC had access to all FAA databases for 2 hours on the morning of 9/11. PTAC, of course, turns out to be another, guess what, Israeli firm. Now, if you go to the next slide see where CBS was reporting, live, Donald Rumsfeld explaining that the Pentagon had gone missing $2.3 trillion, as though he knew something were going to intervene. I mean, giving this report on a Monday when it might grow legs being followed up during the week is something no sophisticated player would do, certainly not him. But as slide 46 shows, the man who was in charge of the Pentagon at the time, Dov Zakheim, was a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. That $2.3 trillion appears to have gone to Israel, and where, you know, Israeli complicity in the crime has grown and grown so that we have a mountain of proof. Here you see on the next slide, Don, where reports of events that were taking place under oath, which were multitudinous. Indeed, I've given a list here where there were over 200 Israeli, they appear to have been Mossad operatives who come in with visas claiming to be art students. A significant group of them was positioned in the Twin Towers. They were doing performance art external to the building. I believe they were prepping to create those holes in the sides of the buildings after the planes effortlessly passed through them. Among the tasks they were assigned appear to have been included planting jammers on building to block Port Authority dispatchers and first responder radios, planting explosives on the New Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge, where the cables are anchored to collapse the bridge, exploding a truck in the Lincoln Tunnel, exploding a truck in the Holland Tunnel, parking trucks with demolition devices in specific parking areas of the Twin Towers, coordinating with Mohammed Atta and his group, except that's part of the mystique intended to blame it on Atta, which, of course, they were simply framed. In fact, a half a dozen of these guys turned up alive and well the following day, Don. David Ray Griffin, in his book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, makes that his very first point, that a half a dozen of these guys showed up alive and well, which obviously would have been impossible had they been suicide bombers and died in these plane crashes. And where even Mohammed Atta's father reported that his son had called him and told him he had nothing to do with it, but he was terrified that he was now going to be killed.
Yeah, virgins, okay.
In Flight 49, you see a van from Urban Moving System, which was another Israeli asset. Five individuals known as the Dancing Israelis were observed in Liberty State Park. They were celebrating, dancing, giving high fives while they filmed the destruction of the Twin Towers. A resident noticed and reported the police who stopped them. The driver told the arresting officer, "We are not the problem. Your problem is our problem. The problem is the Palestinians," which is, at least faintly absurd by any account. But Israel loves to blame others for their own evil deeds. They performed two bombings in Buenos Aires in 1992 and 1994. They blew up their own embassy there. And blamed it on Iran because it had been cooperating with Argentina in the peaceful development. Argentina had been developing with Iran in the peaceful development of nuclear energy. And then 2 years later, 1994, they blew up their own community center because they hadn't killed enough people. I published about this false flag attacks in Argentina, 1992, 1994. In any case, the members of this crew, these five dancing Israelis, were found to have explosive residue in their truck, passports, box cutters, money. They were arrested and incarcerated for 71 days. until they were released by an assistant to then Attorney General John Ashcroft, and they returned to Israel. And guess what? Three of them, as slide number 50 reveals, Don, went on Israeli television and explained they were there to document the destruction of the Twin Towers. The official, which of course implied foreknowledge, the official who is responsible for their release is featured in slide number 51. His name is Michael Chertoff. He was then an assistant to the Attorney General. He would become the second head of the Department of Homeland Security. Like so many other players, he's a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen. I mean, imagine putting this man in charge of the Department of Homeland Security. The very first political speech I ever gave was on 15 April 2008 on the grass in front of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. It was a Ron Paul Freedom Rally, and it would eventually be published under the title 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda, where I explained that it was completely inappropriate to have any dual citizen in a decision-making or policy-shaping position, because who can know that their loyalties to the other state did not outweigh their loyalty to the United States. Thus was it on 9/11, which was brought to us with the active collaboration of dual U.S. Israeli citizens who were in the Department of Defense, having come there from the Project for the New American Century. The next slide, 52, shows what we would expect. This is the destruction of the North Tower, which, of course, was hit first but collapsed last. Look at slide number 53, Don. How could anyone imagine that what they have been told, namely that this was a collapse, could possibly be true? It was no collapse. It was blown apart. Okay. During the next hour on Call for Investigation, yeah, I'm going to talk about how the buildings were destroyed in New York with Richard Sheridan, who's actually an engineer, yeah, from the New York area, who will be joining me. Slide 54, if it plays, is a gift, a short video clip that shows the final parts of the core column of the North Tower turning to dust. Mm-hmm. This appears to have been a result of the use of mini or micro nukes that brought about molecular dissolution of the materials. And as you see in frame number 55, slide 55, we have this massive smoke, dust that was generated. In fact, we have the buildings blown apart from the top down, requiring powerful explosives. The buildings are being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. Very fine dust is a typical manifestation of the use of nuclear devices, which would eventually surround the building. And when it was done, they were destroyed to ground level, Don. Yeah, yeah. Ground level.
That's quite a fire. Well, look at all that smoke. See all that smoke and fire? That's a fire that did
that,
right?
Well, actually, it's not smoke and fire, Don. It's dust from the destruction of the building using nukes.
How about
that?
Now
look at slide number 56, and you'll see what happens when you have a collapse. You have a whole stack of debris. That happened with Building 7, which, as I mentioned, came down at 5:20 in the afternoon. Yeah. And indeed, look at slide number 57.
Yeah.
There you'll see the sequence of the destruction of Building 7. This went down in the afternoon. It was clearly a controlled demolition. No plane hit Building 7. Building 7 had only been suffered very minor damage from the destruction of the Twin Towers. Danny Jawenko, who was an extremely proficient expert in controlled demolition, was shown footage of Building 7 and its destruction, but not told that it was a part of the World Trade Center. And he identified it as an obvious case of a controlled demolition. When told it was it was in the World Trade Center, he could not believe it. Danny Jawenko would later lose his life over this in a mysterious automobile accident that I have no doubt was because he spoke the truth about 9/11. Look at slide number 58, Don. There you see the 5.5 floors of debris from Building 7. Okay, notice that's what you would refer to as pancakes. If the Twin Towers had been destroyed it would have been more than twice that high a stack of pancakes, because 12% of 110 floors would have been 13 or 14 floors. Instead, they were destroyed below ground level. Slide number 59 is very telling, because this is Barry Jennings, who was an official with the New York Emergency Management, who went to the Rudy Giuliani Command and Control Center in Building 7, which had its own air and water supply. When he got there, he found half-eaten sandwiches, still steaming coffee. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here." While he was inside the buildings, explosions were taking place. A series of stairs was blown out from under him. He found himself stepping over dead bodies. He could feel them. He couldn't see them because of the pitch blackness. When he got out, he gave interviews about his experience, which you can still find on YouTube. Barry Jennings talking about his experience in Building 7 while it was being set up for destruction.
In the morning.
Slide number 60. 60 is important, Don.
Absolutely.
Because you see in the background, this is Building 6 with this enormous scooped-out center, mm-hmm. apparently caused by these mini-nuclear devices directed upward. But in the background, you can see that 5.5 floors from Building 7. And in the immediate foreground, you can see some remnants of Building 1, the North Tower, but notice it's destroyed to ground level, destroyed to ground level. The comparison is completely stunning, which is why this slide is so terribly important.
So this Building 6 didn't get blown up by an airplane. That hole didn't get put in there by an airplane, huh?
You are a wise man. You are a wise man. Yes, it was not blown up by an airplane. Slide number 61 has to be one of the most embarrassing gaffes in the history of the media controlled by governments and their intelligence agencies, because a reporter for the BBC, Jane Stanley, was announcing at 4:57 that Building 7, also known as the Solomon Brothers Building, had collapsed, when that was not to take place for 23 more minutes. In fact, if you look at slide 62, you can see they actually captured Building 7, which is, she referred to it as a Solomon Brothers building, because Solomon Brothers Company owned a big chunk of it. This may be the most robustly constructed building in history, Don. It was erected over two enormous electrical generators providing electricity for lower Manhattan. It was designed to never collapse. Even in the construction of the World Trade Center 1 and 2, they used massive steel beams that were hollowed out in the center because they provide virtually as much support. In Building 7, they used solid steel beams. There was no way that building could have come down or collapsed. It was destroyed in a massive controlled demolition. Now, number 63, slide 63 is significant because before even the North Tower had collapsed, they were already reporting that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine had claimed credit for this, simply absurd, and showing images like this of Palestinians rejoicing. This is astonishing, Don, because Palestinians were not rejoicing. They were as dumbfounded as most of the rest of the world. They were watching these events being broadcast on television, speechless and in astonishment. This turns out to be archival footage
from
a religious holiday in Palestine that they were playing as though it were contemporary, Don.
Right.
This is the kind of disinformation to which we were being subjected on 9/11.
Terrible. Yeah. Go ahead.
Slide number 65 shows Rudy Giuliani, who somehow wisely chose not to go to his own command and control center, and who spent a lot of time talking about events in New York. This actually was election day in New York. I think Rudy wanted to catapult it into an additional term for Rudy. It was not to play out that way, but here's a guy who knows how to play the game. When he ran for president, he constantly referred to his role in 9/11, portraying himself as a hero. Well, let me give you a clue. Rudy Giuliani had 110 dump trucks lined up to start hauling away the debris the following day, Don.
Oh.
Ordinarily, New York would take months to line up one dump truck. He had 110. And as Judy Wood astutely observed, those dump trucks weren't just used for hauling debris away. They were bringing in tons and tons of dirt, they were doing here just what was done at Chernobyl. They were covering the disaster area with dirt to absorb the residual radiation. Ooh. 110 dump trucks. In fact, initially, if you followed the debris pile, it was growing after 9/11 because of the tons of dirt.
Huh.
Here in slide number 65, you see Philip Zelikow, who was put in charge of the 9/11 Commission as its executive director. He came from the inner sanctum of the Bush administration. He had helped oversee the transition of the national security apparatus from Bill Clinton to George W. Bush. His academic specialization before he entered government, Don, was the creation and maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S.
Huh.
And indeed, that's what he gave us. Every aspect of the 9/11 Commission report has been shown to be false, including the phone calls from the airplanes, which David Ray Griffin and A.K. Dudney have falsified. They were all fabricated and faked. The plane crash sites, as we've gone through, they were all fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways. And I'll be talking about how it was done in New York during the next show, Call for Investigation, and everything else, including as the two leaders of the commission, you know, Thomas Keene, former governor of New Jersey, and Lee Hamilton, former member of the House, reported in their book, Without Precedent, they were lied to by the government and stonewalled, that the Pentagon gave them three different versions of what had happened there. They were appalled.
Okay, got to wrap it up soon.
Some efforts have been made to bring legal cases, but there's a Jewish judge in New York by the name of Hellerstein, Alvin K. Hellerstein, who has bottled up all of the efforts to bring lawsuits. They don't get anywhere in New York. Here in the next slide, you see two of the key players, Ehud Olmert and Benjamin Netanyahu Consulting. They appear to have been involved in the planning of 9/11. If you wanted to ask who are the brains behind 9/11, these two are the prime candidates. For anyone who has any lingering doubt, check out the website Israel Did 9/11, All the Proof in the World. It was not done by the 19 Islamic terrorists featured in the next to the last slide. That was a cover story that was intended to pervert Americans' attitudes toward Muslim, where 9/11.
No. Uh-oh. Did I lose you?
Transform America to attack any nation that had not attacked us first to one in which we became the leading aggressor nation in the world, whereas General Wesley Clark explained, we went about attacking Afghanistan immediately, a few years later, Iraq, and then, of course, Libya. We've worked our way up to Syria and Iran, but recent moves by Vladimir Putin make it most unlikely that Syria or Iran are going to fall. He sent his MiG-31s to Syria, which are excellent interceptors to preserve Syrian airspace. Although there are 60 ISIS camps, the U.S. isn't attacking because the U.S. created ISIS. We have the Department, the Defense Intelligence Agency documents that show it. Many members of ISIS are sporting U.S. Army tattoos. Russia will go after them. I believe that Assad is going to be preserved. And at the same time, he sent batteries of S-300 surface-to-air missiles to Iran to protect them from continued threats of an Israeli airstrike. It isn't going to happen. Here on the next slide, we see the key message. If no planes crashed, then no passengers died, and no Islamic hijackers caused them to crash. And if no Islamic hijackers caused them to crash, then there was no warrant or any justification for the war on terror. And in the final slide, you see two key players in the United States, George W. Bush, who is largely kept ignorant of matter, and Dick Cheney, who appears to have been executing the operation on the ground from a bunker beneath the White House. Michael Ruppert published a magnificent book entitled Crossing the Rubicon, where he put together all of the publicly available evidence that established.
Hi, I'm Josh Steffler from Freedom Free for All Television. And with the media going completely corporately controlled in this day and age, we couldn't put shows on like this without the help of our independent media partners. MBC, Media Broadcasting Center. So if you like this show, check them out on WeBookYourShow.com, and you can find all sorts of different channels promoting liberty, freedom, and an independent press and an independent media. Thank you for watching.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television set, turn them off, pal. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK show number 75. We've got the team, Larry Rivera, Don Fox, Dr. James Fetzer, and we have an honorary member tonight of the JFK riffraff, Ralph Stinkay. Tonight, we're going to talk about pretty much exclusively Oswald in the doorway. All right. Now, I've got a clip to play, and I need to minimize the screen if I can do that, Chance. And I just want to get that going, and then we'll get the show going. And I also want to announce that Larry Rivera is the chairman of the Oswald Innocence Campaign. So when it comes to Oswald in the doorway, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better team than we have now. However, if you go to other places in JFK, you might get let off the cliff. So we're not going to let that happen. So we're talking about Jim DiEugenio. We have declared war on Black Op Radio. And here we go. I'm going to play a clip of Di Eugenio saying that all this Oswald in the doorway is a big mess. So here we go.
If you believe the Baker Tilly story about Edmund Kemper and Oswald, the Shutter Machine,
yeah,
the second program show, then it makes it harder to believe that's Oswald. Although it could be that. It could be that. But look, you know, so this is something, this is almost as bad as a tree trance. Become so radioactive lately. You know, there's something that only you really want to talk about.
Because I don't think you're ever going to be able to prove that that's awful. I don't think you can. Now, I'm not saying it's not. It doesn't mean to say it's not. Okay? It's either Lovelady or Oswald. But I don't think the weight of the evidence comes down on that it's Lovelady. You know? To go ahead and try and say that that's Oswald today, it's very, very, very difficult. Okay? And I don't think it's worth the effort to try and show the sin because the weight of the evidence simply doesn't back that conclusion.
All right. Enough is enough. All right, fellas. Who wants to take it on first? Ralph, go ahead.
Larry, yes. Begin.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to start off by saying that issue of the doorway has some very interesting characters here, and I want to start off with describing exactly what's going on with the doorway. First of all, we've got up on the screen the audience picture. Which, if we go on to the next slide.
No, we haven't seen it yet, Larry.
Okay.
Yeah, it's up on the first slide, yeah.
Right. Well, we're going to start here with the Auchin's picture, the Auchin's right. Photograph by Ike Auchin. There it is.
It's a very good one.
Yeah, this happens to be the, one of the very best copies of the Auchin's picture. It was provided by Dennis Camino. A couple of years ago, and we use it quite a bit, you know, in our presentations and in our articles because of the clarity of the photograph. However, it still shows quite a bit of alteration, and the next slide is very famous because it was done by Robert Groden, and it shows an extreme close-up of the doorway. Everybody's seen this one before, and all the images here, all the figures that we have already identified, we actually have certain names for some of these people, such as Doorman, Obfuscated Man, Black Hole Man, etc. And
Black Tie Man.
Yeah, Black Tie Man, exactly. And Black Man, Black Profile Man. And later on, we're going to have a sort of wanted to have Ralph be our cleanup hitter here. Towards the latter part of the show, and let him go into the details of why the doorman figure is impossible to be a Billy Lovelady. But before that, I wanted to present living, surviving member of this group here, and it happens to be Bill Wesley Frazier. Now, the next slide that we have here is a depiction here of the doorway as it was in the days after the assassination. If Chance can go ahead and give us the next slide. And then basically what we wanted to show here are were the dimensions of the doorway. If you can, if you look at this and study this, the area up there, you will see that it was very small. In those days, it was only about 3 feet. The top landing was only about 3 feet inwards towards the glass doors themselves. Now, interesting that a couple of years ago, we sent the next slide, please, Chance. We sent Ralph's daughter-in-law over there, Rosie, to actually take a measurements of the doorway, and we discovered that doorway had been pushed in quite a bit by almost 6 feet, so it now measures out to be 9 feet and maybe an inch or two. And during that summer, when I spoke to Gary Shaw, J. Gary Shaw, a very famous author of Cover Up, published in 1976, and he told me that the remodeling of the doorway had been done probably in the 80s when the county took over the building. Now, also, if you look at the front of the building, you'll see that a a lot of remodeling has been done. It's not exactly the way it was on November 22nd, 1963. The very next slide is a reenactment done by OIC member Vince. Hello. Okay. Here we go.
Good sir, Larry.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. This very, very next slide by OIC senior member Vince. I'm sorry.
Salandria.
Yeah, Salandria. Vince Salandria. I'm sorry. I just
Vince, stole.
Yeah, he took this photograph in the summer of 1964. Okay, and the reason that I wanted to show it here briefly is because it shows the exact proportions of the doorway from the exact position that Alchins was on that day. And the very next slide shows the a little bit of a close up of that area, showing the live oak tree that for some reason, some people think that that live oak tree would have blocked the view of the people that were in the doorway. And the reason I'm presenting it here is to show that that would not have been the case. Most of the people there would have been completely visible. Note here that in the actual Alchins 6 photograph, the limos, both limos would have been covering this area. So that's why this view is very important. It gives you an idea of what that doorway would have looked like without those two vehicles present. Now, the very next slide shows that area, exactly that area that I'm talking about. And it's very interesting here because Buell Wesley Frazier, during his deposition before the Warren Commission, gave two different positions during the same deposition of where he was. The first time he said that he was down one step from the top, and the second time on page 242, he said more or less in this black area up here. And this is why it's important to establish the dimension of that doorway, because we will show and we will prove that it would have been impossible for him to be in that position. Okay. Now, the very next slide shows images of Buell Wesley Frazier the night of the assassination when he was taken over to City Hall. Next slide, please. Yeah, well, that's Buell Wesley Frazier at City Hall, okay, 19 years old, where he was picked up at Irving at the hospital where his stepfather was convalescing. And the next slide shows a figure, okay, the next slide shows a figure very similar to Buell Wesley Frazier in the doorway, and this is off of the Wigman film. Okay, and this happens to be when he panned back towards the Texas School Book Depository, towards the entrance. And as Ralph has pointed out, there seems to have been some kind of commotion there, which made Wigman pan back towards the doorway. And maybe later on.
I just want to point out that unfortunately our facial windows here are kind of covering up, you know, the image of Frazier that you're discussing. At least it is for me.
Well, I'm getting a perfect view here of the slideshow. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, really? Okay, good. All right, good.
Yeah. Okay, the next slide, I'm just jumping here real fast because I want to set it all up for you. The very next slide is a comparison of that figure in the doorway. Okay. To the right is a blow up of that figure, and to the left is a figure taken from the video of Frazier that same night. Okay, and we have made this comparison. We see that it's very slim individuals, about 6'1", 6'2", long limbed, the same color. He's wearing the same jacket, Texas Young Farmers of America jacket, and the same type of colored pants and everything. So this is why we inferred that it had to have been Frazier. Now, the very next slide is a clearer image of that. Next slide, please. Of that same image. Yeah, taken from, yeah, this is a lot clearer. And it shows, definitely shows the same type of clothes that he was wearing that night. Okay. Now, this next slide is very interesting, and the reason I bring it up is because some people on the internet have been trying, for some reason, to dispel and try to, for some reason, say that Frazier, that is not Frazier, that is it is some kind of woman there. Well, that
it's for the sake of obfuscation, Larry. I mean, you know, it's not for some reason. It's to obscure the point you're making about the location of Frazier.
I know. So this is just an example of what some people have been putting out on the internet as far as trying to obfuscate, you know, the fact that it really is Frazier there. I mean, there's no way that is a woman there. And anybody who makes a comparison and objectively looks at these images, these figures, will probably say that it's not, it just cannot be. Okay, so I just wanted to bring that one up. The next slide that we have here, again, is Frazier right there in the middle. And I have numbered 1, 2, and 3 in this image to show the three people that are visoring their eyes because of the sun, the noon sun there. And regardless of who those people are, what the reason I'm presenting them here is because they set the position of that individual there. He's right in between all three of those people. And when we extrapolate those into the option six photograph in the next, which we'll see in the next slide here. Next slide, please. Yeah, you'll see that for some reason that figure that we have identified as Frazier is not there. Now, I'm on record as saying that Frazier most probably was removed from the image. Now, anybody, you know, who looks at this, you know, should make up their own mind just by studying, you know, the angles and everything. And but it seems to me that Frazier has been removed from that image, and we have studied what happened to Frazier that night because he could have been an alternate patsy. And in order for him to have been an alternate patsy shooting from the sixth floor, southeast window of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, he couldn't have been caught in any images that day. So this could have been the reason why Frazier was removed from the Alton 6 photograph. And the very next photograph, slide shows Frazier's handwritten statements of what position he took up that day on the entrance of the School Book Depository. It clearly says that I was standing on the front steps of the building when the president came by, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, the next slide that I wanted to present shows all the different versions of where Frazier said he was during the assassination. And briefly here, you can see that in different venues at different times, he said standing on the front steps, and then, like I just mentioned before, standing by the rail or more or less in the black area that was in his Warren Commission testimony at the Clay Shaw. He said he was at the top of the stairs, and Lovelady and Shelley were down right in front of me at the bottom of the steps. And that is very key because it shows the ambiguity here of Frazier. And then at the HSCA, where he did not testify, but he was interviewed, he gave two different positions again.
Well, and showing that he's lying, Larry. He's lying his head off.
Well, that's, I'm just presenting the information for our audience to make up their minds, you know.
He can't have been in two different positions at the same time, and he's attributing to himself at least three, and he's mislocating Lovelady and Shelley.
Not only that, then later on in 1986 at the mock trial, he did identify Lovelady as standing in front of him, four steps in front of him. Now, that would have placed Lovelady down at the bottom of the steps again.
So, that doesn't work for Lovelady as doorman, does it?
That's right. So basically, and then the next slide is one of the most obscene images I've ever seen, and this is Vincent Bugliosi with a very extremely cropped version of the Alton 6 photograph, leading Frazier to state where he was, where he's saying that he was in that dark area in the back, which is impossible because given the dimensions that we have already set here There wasn't any room. Right. So the very next, so if for comparison basis, the very next slide, shows you again, we go back to the Grodin slide and it shows that, dark area, you know, there's just no space for him to have been there. Okay. So, now, if, this, next clip will play, if not, it's just,
it's a GIF?
Yeah, okay, it doesn't play, but it's basically Frazier at City Hall. And, this was taken from the video and, where he makes some, statements and whatever, but we can skip that. But, very next slide is Billy Lovelady. And this is the famous, photo shoot done on the 29th of February where he wore, and this is a very nice, image, very, clear photograph, here of him, in his vertically striped shirt. Okay. And, a lot of the,
This of course was taken by the FBI, which asked him to come in and show them the shirt he had been wearing that day. And he came in and showed them this shirt as a shirt he was wearing that day.
Exactly. Exactly. And the very next slide is one of my all time favorites because this little collage here shows Gorilla Man. Okay. And this is a very, very important, image here because if you look closely at his left breast pocket, there's a little pocket there, okay?
Flap,
right, with a flap, okay? And when you compare it to the shirt that Billy Lovelady wore for Robert Grodin in 1976, when Grodin and Bruton went to see him, to photograph him for the HSCA, that flap isn't there, okay? So this is a conundrum for all these people who keep insisting that Billy Lovelady is doorman, and this is the shirt that he wore.
And it's a conundrum, as Judith explained, for Grodin to have claimed that the pattern of the checkered shirt is a closer match to doorman's shirt than Oswald's shirt, because she showed precisely the opposite to be the case.
Exactly. So, this is one of the... one of the most important aspects of the shirt, of the checkered shirt, the plaid shirt, when you make the comparison between one and the other, it's impossible, okay? Now, I'm almost finished
Larry,
here.
Larry, it seems to me that when they had Frazier say that Lovelady was down in front of him, that was to bolster the idea that Lovelady could have been Gorilla Man.
Possibly, but don't forget that the Martin film has Gorilla Man several minutes, many minutes after the shooting, possibly what 10-15 minutes afterward.
Yeah.
So, right. So it's possible, but Frazier was all over the place, and as time went by, he became more and more confused as far as his location. So, yeah. So the
you
next
got one more slide, or was that it, Larry?
Yeah, just one more. This is Joe Molina, and who happens to be obfuscated man.
Yeah,
obfuscated man, and short. Molina was no more than 5'1", stocky. The attire matches what he wore day in and day out because he was assistant credit manager and he wore a long sleeve shirt and tie. And this is one of the only pictures that I have found of Molina, and because he has never been seen in public. He's never spoken in public about the assassination or his location.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive in, I believe, Carrollton. That's a northern suburb of Dallas.
Wow.
And he's still around. He's 90, I believe, 91, 92 years old. Yeah.
Lewis is still alive.
Yeah.
Now, Ralph has been wonderfully patient. So I think we want to bring in our guest for the evening.
That's
Ralph.
Right.
Hey.
Yeah, just jump the next couple of slides and we're right at Ralph.
All right. I brought two
Next one.
Oh, wait a minute. Is this one of yours, Larry?
Yeah, this is the last one regarding
Go back and use it. That looked very interesting.
Yeah,
let's go back, please.
Yeah, the identification. Yeah, Well, we got Bill Shelley, Otis Williams, Billy Lovelady, Joe Molina, Bill Wesley Frazier, Lee Oswald, and Roy Lewis. And Ralph has been studying the Roy Lewis situation lately, and he's got other opinions on that. But this is basically what we have come up with. And, you know, like I said, I've said it before, you know, and that we don't have to agree on everything, but most of these images happen to be a pretty good description of where these people were that day.
Excellent. Great work. Great work.
Thank you, Larry.
All right.
Okay, I brought two collages that compare Oswald with the doorman figure. You might say they're my favorite ones. This one I think of as the premier collage because as we look at it, every single element matches. There isn't one thing that jumps out at us as an exception.
Not well, you can't see the bottom split because of the black man's profile.
Well, all right, but from what we can see, in terms of his face, his facial features, shape of his face, let me also point out the length of his neck, and that's an important thing because some people have long necks, some people have short necks. These two match. Everything matches very well. Now, I want to ask the audience, as they're looking at this, to think about their own experience going to work, where you're seeing different people and how every individual looks distinctive, like him, his one and only self, and that also the world of clothing is very big, where usually there's a very distinctive look to every person's dress, whether they're male or female. How many work days would it take to have an experience in which you went to work in which you saw two men, and not where they're related or identical twins, but two unrelated men looking this much alike, and not only looking this much alike, but dressing this much alike. The man and the clothes are two separate things. You almost have to think of it like winning the lottery twice.
Ralph, let me just...
Once because the men match so well, and you won the lottery... A second time because the clothes match so well.
Let me just interject, Ralph, that you were the one who convinced me that it was the clothing, the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the T-shirt that made the match rather than the face, because it's clear the face on the doorman photograph has been altered in various ways.
Well, right. In some ways they did. But anyway, the final point I want to make about this image is simply that if you had to say, how many work days would it take before you got to a day in which you went to work and you saw this much likeness between two men and the man and the clothing? Well, if you said it would take a million work days to have one day in which this happened, I think that would be an understatement. I think it would be more like 10 million days if it happened at all. It's just that striking how alike they are.
When was the last time that you went anywhere in your life and was dressed exactly like someone else? It's never happened. And that's the number one thing.
It's never happened to me. All right, now the next image, if you'll click forward. Okay, I like this image. I put this on the OIC website. And it's because of the expression. You know, when a person, as they live, as they breathe, they develop a habit to kind of... arrange their face a certain way with a certain amount of squint in the eyes. You can think of the eyes as being inserted into a well, a socket. And it's framed by the prominence of the brow bone above and by the prominence of the cheekbone below. Now, what I like about this is that we're seeing the same depth in the eye on both of them and the same intensity of the look. There's a very, very similar expression here, especially around the eyes. Notice also that both of them have the same descending notch on the T-shirt, which was Oswald's distinctive attribute. And then I want you to notice that when we look at Oswald's shirt on the right, that it actually shows quite a lot of contrast. You're seeing a slight, faint, kind of a checkered look where you're seeing some... texture to it. And you're also seeing some areas of white on this brown shirt. Now, what that represents is light reflection. This was an old shirt, and some of the areas of it were very thin, and they were shiny, and they reflected the light. So even in this photo on the right, we're seeing some areas of light reflection. And overall, we're seeing quite a lot of contrast. Now, some people have tried to claim that the contrast on Doorman's shirt was because it was a plaid shirt like the one Love Lady supposedly wore. But actually, the contrast is simply haze distortion from blowing up this very small image. And there's also light reflection going on. So that's all it is. And we're seeing it on both sides. Okay, let's move. Next picture. Okay. Now, the reason I put this here, let me introduce this. One of the developments that I feel we have reached is that not only are we absolutely certain now that Oswald was the man in the doorway, but all the alternatives to it have been completely eliminated. They have been refuted. There isn't even anything, any place else that's plausible anymore. In other words, if you admit that he wasn't up on the sixth floor shooting at Kennedy, well, then there really is no place else to put him but the doorway. But so let me explain. This is a diagram of the second floor lunchroom. And there are some people who very flippantly say, well, Oswald was in the lunchroom at 12:30. That's where he said he was. That's not true, of course. What he said was that he was out with Bill Shelley in front. We didn't learn that until the late 1990s, but we did learn it. But this is a picture of the second floor, and it shows the lunchroom. And in front of the lunchroom was a smaller room, a little. And really, the purpose of this room was just to be a passageway so that people from the office area could access the lunchroom, and people who came up the stairs could access the lunchroom. So there was a doorway from each of those places into this small little room, which is called a vestibule. And then there was a third door in the vestibule, which was the door that went from it to the lunchroom. And that door was propped open. This is according to Marion Baker. So he comes up the stairs, and he's in the stairwell, and there's a glass door, there's a glass window in the door that he can see through. And he sees Oswald coming through the other door on the other side, which is from this office area. And Oswald goes through this door, and then he turns and goes into the lunchroom. And that door was already open, so he didn't have to open anything. And so Baker follows him and enters the vestibule. And when he does, and he gets inside this room, he sees Oswald walking through the lunchroom. That's the story. Now, the point is that since Oswald had just reached the vestibule when Baker saw him, it means that he just got there, which means that he wasn't there a minute and a half ago. So whether you believe the story of Baker and seeing Oswald in the lunchroom, if we just for a moment, if we just assume that it's true, then it proves that Oswald just got there. That's the thing. Oswald just got there. He got there at, you know, 12:30 and a half, whatever time it was, but he wasn't there a minute and a half before, and then was wandering around out here in this space, and then returned and went back to the lunchroom. That makes no sense at all.
You would have been around 12:31 and a half, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. Now, what really happened is that Oswald was in the doorway, and he did not go up the steps that Baker and Truly took. That's in back. There was another stairwell in front, right next to the doorway, in the southeast corner. It only traveled for one flight. That's it. It only went from the ground floor to the second floor, and it was actually a very elegant stairway. It wasn't anything like this one. This was very utilitarian. It was rough. It was unfinished. This one in front was actually kind of glitzy and fancy. That's the one that they had their visitors use, I guess. It looked like a staircase that Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers could have danced on. But that's the stairway that he came up, and he must have walked either through the hallway or just through the open space of the office to get to this vestibule. And that's when Baker saw him. And it all works out time-wise for that to be true. But the point is that there is no way that Oswald was there at 12:30 when he just got there at 12:31 and a half. So that's ruled out automatically. Let's go to the next slide. All right. The reason I put this up is because the only other place that anyone has offered as an alternative to either the doorway or the sixth floor, if they don't like either one, is to say that Oswald was in the first floor lunchroom at 12:30 eating. Now, Oswald got off work at 11:45, just like everyone else. And they were told, they actually got off 15 minutes early, and they were told, we're letting you off early so that you can eat your lunch and do your drinking, take care of whatever you need to do, so that at 12:30, you'll be able to just watch the motorcade and you won't be involved with anything else. That was the whole idea. So the very idea that Oswald would get off at 11:45, as he did, and just hang around, do nothing for 45 minutes, and then decide to start eating at 12:30 and miss the motorcade, even as a behavior, that doesn't make any sense. But what Oswald said is that he ate his lunch in the first floor lunchroom, a cheese sandwich, an apple, which he got from Mrs. Payne's house, and that he did it at a time when this man, Harold Norman, and his friend James Jarman, who was standing just a little behind him, were milling around downstairs in and around the lunchroom. That's what Oswald said. So that's the reference that we have. That's the time that Oswald was there. So what time was it? Well, after they did that, and you see, the way it was that in this first floor lunchroom, and that's where most of the grunt workers were. The second floor lunchroom was actually more right. for the higher ups. Exactly. The grunt workers, the order fillers and whatnot, they ate downstairs. Exactly. And along the window, there was like a rack or a little ledge. And everybody would show up in the morning and they would throw their sandwich or whatever on that ledge. And then they would come back at lunchtime and get it and they would eat. And so everybody did that. Oswald did it. These guys did it. And that's why they ran into each other in the lunchroom. They weren't actually eating together. It's not as though they sat down and were breaking bread and you know, chewing the cud together. But they were there at the same time, and Oswald referenced them. But after they were there, they went outside, and they took a position outside to watch the motorcade from outside. And that they may have been outside for 7 or 8 minutes, and then they got the bright idea, no, we should go upstairs and watch this from the window. So they walked around the block. They didn't go back in through the front door. They walked all the way down Houston Street, so a full city street. They turned around and went to the back of the building. They re-entered the building through the back door. They took the freight elevator up to the fifth floor. Then they got out, and they had to walk the entire length of the fifth floor to get to this window. Now, what time did they get there? I estimate that they got there about 12:25, just a few minutes before the motorcade arrived. And what happened was this guy, Bonnie Ray Williams, who was a good friend of theirs, he heard them making a little noise down there on the fifth floor. He was up on the sixth floor all the time. And I want you to think about that, that officialdom has it that that Oswald did the shooting from the sixth floor, where he had to go up there and move maybe 20 boxes in order to set up the sniper's nest. And he had to retrieve his rifle, and he had to assemble his rifle, and no screwdriver was found. So they suggested Oswald used a coin, like a dime, like a screwdriver, to put the rifle together. So he had to do all of that, adjust the sight and adjust the scope and get all this ready. But Bonnie Ray Williams was up there by himself to at least 12:20 and probably 12:25. He didn't move until he heard Jarman and Norman one flight below him. And being a social guy, he didn't want to watch the motorcade by himself. He thought that they were going to join him on the sixth floor. But when he could hear them down on the fifth floor, he went downstairs. But obviously, Oswald could not get started. He couldn't even get started until Bonnie Ray Williams split. So how could he possibly do all that in a few minutes? It's just ridiculous. But anyway, this picture proves that Oswald was not eating at 12:30 because he was eating in the midst of these guys, and these guys weren't there at 12:30. They were up here, and they went through a very roundabout way to get up there. So there is no way that Oswald was still in the first floor lunchroom at 12:30. So what that means is he wasn't in the second floor lunchroom. He was not in the first floor lunchroom. And there is literally no place else that you can even theoretically put him. If he wasn't on the sixth floor and he wasn't in either of the lunchrooms, then unless you want to say he was, you know, going to the bathroom relieving himself, then the only other place he could have been was that doorway, and that is where he was. All right, let's move on. Next picture. Okay. All right. I want to spend the rest of my time talking about some recent developments for me. It's been a very exciting thing. This concerns an area of the Alchin's photo that I haven't really focused on up until lately. And it starts with this figure of Emory Roberts, who was the lead Secret Service agent. If you look at this Alchin's photo, you can see that there is a smudge over his mouth. Now, this was a professional photo taken by one of the leading photojournalists in the country at the time, James Alchin's. He had the best equipment. He had the best film available. And there is simply no photographic reason why that smudge should be there. So I uploaded it to a software program called Picasa, and I did what they call a flooding with light, where it just basically fills the whole thing with light. And let's move to the next slide, please. All right.
That's a blow up. That's a blow up.
This didn't come out as good as I wanted.
Ralph, that's a blow up that I inserted prior to the slide that you're talking about.
All right. Well, where's the one that I sent you at the last minute? I sent you one.
Over his mouth. The next one will be the one that you're looking for.
All right. Let's see. Go to the next one then. I'm gonna have to help you a little bit with this. If you look, you can see his eyeglasses, you can see his nose, so you know where his face is. So if you look a little bit to the left, that's his thumb. That is his thumb. And the expanse on the right is the rest of his hand, his fingers. And the space in between is his web. Now, let me show you on my hand. This is the thumb, of course. These are the other fingers. And this tissue right in here between the thumb and the fingers is known in medicine as the web of the hand. And it's actually the thinnest tissue in the body in terms of the outside of the body and the external body. That's as thin as it gets anywhere in your external body. So it became apparent to me that he had his hand raised to his mouth as if he was holding a microphone, a speaking device. And really what it was a police car phone. You know, they didn't have cell phones in those days, but they did have car phones. And he was speaking on the phone. And this was at a time when JFK was being shot to death. Now, let's consider how many shots have already gone off. This is the Alchin's photo. There was a shot that missed, so that's one. There was a shot that hit Kennedy in the back, so that's two. And if you're willing to discount the single bullet theory as I am, there was a shot to his throat, which was from the front, so that's three. Now, there may have been more shots than that, but there definitely were no less than three shots already sounded at the time of the Alchin's photo. So this man has heard three shots, and he's looking at Kennedy. And Kennedy's got his arms up to his throat like this. That's not a normal behavior. You don't just drive along in a motorcade and do that. Obviously, if you do that, you're struggling. You're straining.
Ralph, just to make a correction, that there have been three shots doesn't mean that he would have heard them, because most of the shots were with silenced weapons, which would mean he very well might not have heard them.
Oh, I didn't think about that. All right. But there were people that reported hearing, you know, shots and sounds. So he may have certainly have heard something. But anyway, the point is, at a time like that, what was he doing talking on the phone? I mean, he was a Secret Service agent. He was the head of this team, supposedly highly experienced, highly trained.
Well,
once he got any idea in his head that Kennedy was under attack, he should have taken immediate action.
He was coordinating the assassination, Ralph.
That's right.
Well, that's
it's not actually a mystery. But the point is, you're showing his overt, complicit engagement in coordinating the assassination photographically in the Alchin's.
Okay, well,
he's telling Greer to stop.
Let's go on, please. All right, now, did we look at the picture of There's a picture of that takes in the whole car, the Queen Mary, the secret.
Yeah, that was prior. That was prior.
All right, go back to that. I need to see that again.
Well, that's quite a ways back.
No, two images back, two slides back. One more.
All right, very good. This is exactly right. Now, this is something that is a new discovery for me. Larry informed me later that Dennis Cimino already figured this out, but it's only lately that I've been looking at this figure of George Hickey. That's the guy with the fat head that's rising up in the back of the car, in which he has his head to us. We're seeing the rear of his head. It struck me very, very strangely that he should be exhibited like that. I want you to think about the situation mechanically. This is a car in which there's three rows of seats. The front row where the driver is with Roberts. Then there was a middle row which had Powers and O'Donnell, who were both JFK aides. And then you had this rear seat that contained Bennett and it contained Hickey. But in this picture, Hickey is definitely not standing because he was a tall man. He was a very tall man. And if he were standing, he would be much higher than he is here. He would be every bit as high as Hill and the others if he were standing. So he's not standing. But he's not sitting either, because it would be impossible to sit in that position, because it's a car seat. And you can't actually sit. You can only sit one way. You can only sit forward. If you tried to turn around and sit, you couldn't do it because you have no place for your legs to go. So, and he couldn't possibly be twisted that much. In other words, his legs are not facing forward. His knees aren't facing Kinney with him twisted around that much, because he'd have to be a rubber band to twist that much. So the only way that he could mechanically be where he seems to be is if he was kneeling on that seat. Now that's a possibility, but he never said that he was kneeling. Nobody else said that he was kneeling. And I think there's really no reason to stipulate that, because there are no grounds to. There's no evidence. There's no reports that he was ever kneeling.
Well, but Ralph, there don't seem to be any alternatives then that he was kneeling.
Yes, you're right. As we look at it, there are no other alternatives but that he was kneeling, except the other alternative is that isn't him, that he was put into that photo.
Okay.
For a reason. Now, let's go on now to the other photo that we were looking
at. Three forward.
All right. Now, this image on the left is Hickey. It is definitely Hickey. I think it's from a Willis frame. I'm not sure. And what I want you to do is compare the height of the hairline between these two men.
Distinctly different.
Distinctly different. In other words, I'm talking about the distance between the top of the collar and where the hair ends. The area
and around the ears, too.
Of visible skin. Yeah, that's another good point, around the ears. In other words, the way I like to put it is that Hickey's barber got a little carried away trimming him. He kind of made the hairline a little bit too high. You know, when I go to the barber, he always asks me, do you want to have the hairline rounded or just squared off?
And of course, he brought his cat along on his back.
But in this case, the barber got a little carried away, and this man has got a much higher hairline than this man. But in addition to that, you can see that this man has got just generally a different shaped head, that it looks more oblong, whereas this man, he's got a very round head, sort of like Charlie Brown in the Peanuts comics. So they are definitely two different men. So what I believe is that they took this image and they basically pasted it over the image of Hickey, whatever it actually was. Now, I can only speculate as to why they did it, and I have a few ideas as possibilities. One is that Hickey may have just showed a very inappropriate expression. Maybe he was snickering. Maybe he was smirking, like maybe he just had a kind of a smile on his face. Or maybe he had some kind of a cunning, kind of a devious look that just they felt was going to just give a bad impression. So they decided to do him over. And the other thing I think is that they decided that as long as they were stuck with this lemon, they were going to turn it into lemonade. And what I mean is they gave themselves another Secret Service agent who was looking at the for the source of the shots. Now, remember, there was a caption that was written by the AP that went out with all the Alchin's photos that went to the newspapers. And what it said was, one of the things it said was, you can see the Secret Service agents looking for the source of the shots. Now, I want you to think, first of all, about the fact that if assuming that they really did hear shots and they thought that there were shots or that there could be shots, looking for the source of the shots wasn't even the right thing to do anyway. Because if Kennedy is under attack, regardless of where the person is who's shooting, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, in other words, they weren't going to take a gun out and start shooting back. There was nothing they could do from this distance. The only thing they could do of any practical value was to get Kennedy out of there, to get that driver to step on the gas and just take off like a man out of hell. That's what they needed Kennedy to do.
Ralph, we have about 4 minutes left.
Okay. But instead, this guy, Emery, was talking on the phone, and you have these Secret Service agents supposedly looking for the source of the shots, but that wasn't going to do any good at all. Okay, let's keep going. All right, I put this photo in. It's a little hard to see, but let me quickly explain it. This is a photo of Hickey. It's from the Nix film. And what I want you to see is the black striping in the back of his neck. Can you see that very artifactual looking black stuff there? It's rectangular. It's very dark. It's a deeper black than the rest of him. I believe that what they did was just basically paint that in because they knew that that high hairline on him would have been a contradiction to the Hickey that they were trying to sell in the Alchin's photo. So they went in and they did the opaquing to block out that high neck where they have a lot of visible neck, which the other guy did not have. And that's why you're seeing so much of this. I think that was the last one, right? So if there's 2 minutes left, let's go back to.
No, there you go.
Well, let's go back to
Richard Hook's 50 ID points that I inserted.
50 ID points done by Richard Hook. Let me go back to that last broad picture of the Queen Mary where we see all the agents in it. I'd have one last point to make. So you're going to go back about four ones. Go back.
Before that.
One more.
Okay. What I want to point out here, look at Clint Hill. Look where his eyes are looking. He's looking at Roberts. He knows Kennedy's in trouble. I've looked at the Zapruder film, and in earlier frames than this, you can see Hill is looking at Kennedy, but here he's looking at Roberts talking on the phone. Look at Mr. Powers. He also seems to be looking at Mr. Roberts. Maybe Hickey was looking at Roberts too. Roberts is the focus of attention here for all these guys. Why? Well, I have a suspicion that Hill was waiting to get a signal from Roberts. Hill was not ready to go at this point. Even though Kennedy's been shot, even though sounds are going off, if you look closely, you can see that Hill's legs are crossed. He's got his right foot crossed, and his right leg is crossed in front of his left leg. He would have to undo that before he could even begin to start running toward the limo. So this tells me that he, at this point, is nowhere near ready to start running. I have a feeling that he waited until Roberts finished talking to whomever, and Roberts gave him a signal, and it was probably waiting until the fatal headshot got delivered so that they knew that Kennedy was finished, and then it was time for some heroism, so they sent Clint Hill on his merry way.
Well, Ralph, let's not forget that Emery Roberts is the one who was responsible for calling off Henry Ripka at Love Field from the JFK limo.
That's very true.
For sure. And Emery Roberts was in charge of setting JFK up. I mean, we have more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity, and Roberts is at the center of it all.
That's right.
Roberts also restrained Reddy.
Yeah.
Supposedly, according to Roberts, Reddy was ready to bolt for the limo too, but
Reddy was ready, and Roberts said no.
That's also, it's interesting that later on, I think 3 years later, Roberts, I believe, committed suicide.
He died in the 1960s, but who knows? You know, suspicious death. But
he knew too much, Larry. They would have bumped him off. Humor.
Roberts eventually admitted that he was talking on the phone. He admitted it, but he made it sound like it was later than this. That after the fatal headshot, he was claimed to the Secret Service agents in the lead car, who say I think his name was Lowry.
Great job, Ralph. Gary.
Yeah. All right. On the way out, Chance, can you play the Garrison Harold Weisberg clip, and that'll be it for JFK number 75. And if you're not careful, I'm beginning to think that you might guys might be disagreeing with Mr. DiEugenio. All right, so play that for us, and we'll be out of here.
Facts now.
Oswald was not involved.
Stop the lies! Oswald, outside!
The first floor watching the parade.
As the first shots were fired at the president, Associated Press photographer James Alkins took this photograph. In the background, standing in the doorway of the depository, is someone who looks like Lee Harvey Oswald. The FBI, after what they said was careful analysis of Oswald's arrest photos and the shirt, said the man in the doorway was someone else they had discovered, named Billy Lovelady.
Billy Lovelady may very well have been standing in the doorway, as he said. He could not be the man in Alton's picture. And if that is true, then Oswald was on the first floor at the...